This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Hello and welcome to The Feed with Amber Mack.
And Michael B. for everything new now and next.
We have you covered for what's happening in the world of tech and what's trending online.
On the show, we tell you why Canada's sweetheart keeps investing in Stripe.
Plus everything you want to know about astronaut training and heading to space.
Also on the show, Amber has the very best in summer tech for the whole family.
And we talked to the founder of Thinking Huts about building schools out of 3D materials.
That's all coming up right here on The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B.
This episode of The Feed is powered by TP-Link. TP-Link routers and technology can remove wireless pain points in your home so you have better performance for working, streaming, and gaming.
Trending up.
Well, Amber, I went out on the weekend, I sat outside, and I spoke to a person, and I had a Starbucks.
Really, Michael? That's pretty impressive, actually. It makes a big difference when you can actually see people and leave your house.
Yeah. So if for context, everybody listening that isn't in Toronto or hasn't been in Toronto for the last 8-9 months, we finally started to open up a fraction. Nothing crazy, but it feels like, you know, I am starting to have a little bit of hope. Yeah. And I think you are too, right? You're getting ready for summer. You're hoping to finally be maybe reunited with your family. You're not sure yet. So I think a lot of people are kind of still feeling it out and hoping that they can start to have some kind of summer.
Yeah. I mean, I think it just, you know, the news has been continuously getting better and better all the time. So very thankful for that. And it's a relief. I think here in Ontario, we've definitely had a difficult time in terms of being sort of in some form of lockdown. And it's nice to just feel like we have the summer to get people vaccinated. And then hopefully in September, we have a good return to some kind of normal.
Some kind of normal. Well, let's get to it. Speaking of normal, companies seem to be going gangbusters regardless.
Yeah, absolutely. So a report came out in the past day or so that according to the journal, Shopify has invested over $350 million in Stripe. If you're not familiar with Stripe, it's a payment processing company. As one example, when I go to my local farmer's market and I buy, say, a bunch of corn from one of the farmers, many of them have Stripe now. So I can just use this little sort of square device it's called Stripe, and I just tap to pay. So this is an example.
And it usually just gets attached to a smartphone or something, right? So it makes it super easy for that payment.
Exactly. So Shopify has invested quite a bit of money in that company, which makes sense. There are some publications saying that it could be even more than the number that I quoted. But really, I think it just speaks to the power of Shopify and how they are in many ways making it easier for small businesses and entrepreneurs to be able to leverage the latest technology in a seamless way, an accessible way to be able to build and grow their businesses.
I think also, though, Shopify is concerned from a bigger picture of slowing down in growth with businesses coming on board. So this obviously makes sense from a business perspective to start to look at other avenues to grow their business. And so making that payment solution a lot easier for small businesses and merchants, of course, makes sense. And they are, you know, investing alongside some giants. So they're in good company. Obviously, Sequoia, one of the biggest venture capital firms, as well. So, you know, they're in good company there. And I think also Shopify, you know, things are changing, and obviously not every headline with Shopify is positive. So they've had changing of the guard out of their 7-people executive team. They've seen some members leave. So I think that, you know, Shopify has grown so quickly into such a mammoth company. It will be interesting to see where they go and how they develop from here, because we've seen this time and time again happen. So hopefully they're able to stay, you know, at the top of their game and in good stead as a Canadian leading company.
Yes, absolutely. So always one to keep an eye on. Next up, we wanted to talk about a possible new feature on Twitter. A Twitter designer has teased a feature that would let you possibly remove your handle from someone else's already published tweet. This is kind of interesting. I think they're trying, if this is in fact true, to have new tools out there that would mean that there was less sort of piling on and abuse. So let's say you tweeted something and you're a journalist. People wouldn't necessarily be able to see your handle, and maybe there would be less harassment, which is a real issue for many journalists.
Yeah. And I think that in general, you know, people can tag you or mention you and you don't really have any control over that. So I think that they are, yeah, they're toying with this idea of being able to edit if you are in somebody else's post or mention that you don't want to be in, especially if, and we've seen this time and time again, happen on social media feeds, that it can turn into a tirade and trolling and all of the negative stuff. So if you're able to remove yourself from that, you can keep it out of your feed and keeping yourself out of being involved in that. So I think, you know, it could be interesting. Although, you know, before this, though, Jack Dorsey has said that he wouldn't have edit features for tweets. So this might be a step in that direction, but we'll see how it unfolds.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so for our last story, we wanted to talk about how the inventor of the World Wide Web is selling the source code for his invention as an NFT. So we've talked about NFTs in the past. This is an auction that Sir Tim Berners-Lee is doing, according to Mashable. And he's selling it at a Sotheby's auction. So if you don't know what an NFT is, it's a type of cryptocurrency, as they explain here, that resides on a smart contract platform. And I think this is kind of fascinating to see that this is happening. Apparently, it's opening up on June 23rd and will start at about $1,000. But let's face it, Michael, we've seen what NFTs...
It's going to go... I reckon it's going to turn into something like a millions of dollars tag. I don't understand if people have that much money to spend, they might be able to use it for something a little bit more useful for other people or society. But, you know, we'll see what the price tag goes for. It is interesting, though, because it is the source code. And it's I thought that was fascinating of what they're turning into an NFT. And it's going to be animated. It's going to be an animated visualization of the code. So from an artistic perspective, maybe that's something to be interested in and admire and kind of look at. But I'd be interested to also know where the money's going to go and if it's going to go to something useful.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think we have a lot of information about that just yet. But certainly there's going to be a lot of fanfare. It's not a word I use all the time, so I wanted to say it like that, about this announcement come June 23rd, which is just around the corner. So we will keep an eye on that and hopefully have an update on the final auction price. Should be pretty interesting.
It will be interesting. But you know what we should be making fanfare about? Our next guest. So if you stay with us, we're going to be returning to chat about how building schools from 3D materials. So something really interesting and a really good cause in third world countries.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Techstar.
Would you be surprised to learn that 1.2 billion children were displaced globally as a result of the pandemic, and more than 260 million children have no access to education worldwide? Well, Maggie Grout is on a mission to help change this by building schools out of 3D printed material through her nonprofit company, Thinking Huts. Now, it serves underprivileged communities. Maggie is joining us now to share how this technology is helping decrease construction time from months to mere days. Maggie, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. Let's start with Thinking Huts and its mission and what you guys are all about and how you are going about achieving this.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I guess I could start off by talking about the mission. So we're trying to close the global opportunity gap through innovative solutions. So we're primarily focusing on utilizing 3D printing to build schools. And where we're at right now, we're fundraising throughout the summer to launch our first 3D printed school in Madagascar. The pandemic has definitely been a bit of an obstacle, but we're hoping everything will stay on track and then we'll continue building schools throughout Madagascar the next 3 to 5 years.
So let's talk a little bit about 3D printing, because this is a term that has been thrown around for many, many years, and you can do incredible things. But just for people who don't totally understand how 3D printing relates to what you do, can you just talk about why it makes that sense in the context of what you're doing with Thinking Huts?
Of course. So we're utilizing a different type of 3D printing. Usually people will think it's a desktop size and printing plastics, but we're going to use an architectural scale printer that extrudes a concrete mixture. And the benefits of 3D printing when applied to school construction is that we can decrease the construction time, which typically takes months or years, to a matter of days once the process is perfected.
And it's not just the 3D printed material that you're using to construct these schools. You're also using locally sourced materials.
Yes, exactly. It was very important to me to also involve the local economy. So my pitch to the architects was to have a hybrid design that has the 3D printed component, but also the local materials for everything else, such as the roof and doors.
So let's talk a little bit about the actual rollout. People can donate to help. What does this look like as you raise a certain amount of money and you start building? Can you walk us through that process and maybe talk a little bit about why Madagascar is one place you've chosen to start?
Of course. So people can get involved at thinkinghuts.org. We're trying to raise about $200,000 throughout the summer. And then this covers all the printer transportation and everything, so we can launch the first one, and then also covering the next three for next year. And then for Why Madagascar, I actually have personal connections on the ground. I had considered over 7 countries because I've been working on this particular project for about 6 years. But I had chosen Madagascar due to the larger need for infrastructure, because with education, it's such a large problem to tackle. In some countries, infrastructure might not be the number one problem.
When people hear that you're building schools, it sounds like a mammoth task. So can you walk us through exactly the size of the construction? How much does it actually cost? Because I think people will be surprised to understand just how little it does compared to what we might be, you know, used to hearing and seeing in developed countries.
Yeah, so with the costs, we're estimating we can get this down to close to $20,000, which is more than half the cost of a traditional school building in the developing world. And then, of course, if you compare it to the U.S., schools here are closer to the millions. So it's definitely a decrease in the costs over the years, too.
Now, I don't think it's appropriate to really talk about how old people are, but I was reading in Smithsonian Magazine that you founded this company, Thinking Huts, a nonprofit, as a 15-year-old, a senior in high school. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that experience is like continuing to pursue your education? But also trying to change the world.
Well, thank you. That's really sweet of you to say. Yes, I did start it at quite a young age. I have been balancing it with school. I actually just graduated from university last month, so I'm getting to work on it full time. I would say it was definitely a struggle in the beginning. A lot of people did think I was crazy, especially when you're younger. I think people sort of write it off that it's just some random idea, but I just stuck with it over the years, and it's really cool to see people also excited to hear about the main vision for what I hope to do.
And what about the partnerships? How did you go about finding the right partners to be able to build the school and hopefully schools in the future? Because I imagine that process itself was difficult to find the robotic side of things. And then, of course, the architecture. And then, of course, when you do decide a destination, all of the rules and regulations and all of those things also come into play.
Yes, of course. So a lot of it was cold calling, and I made up my mind mainly due to values. So with the architect, he was very interested in sustainability, which was important to me, and also incorporating local culture within the design. And then for the technology partner, that was also something I took seriously, because I think with any technology partner, you're going to be working with them a long time. So I wanted to make sure that they were respectful, and they also they understood how I wanted to apply the technology and empower the countries we work with.
It's really incredible in terms of what you've been able to bring together and build. One last question for you in terms of the future of Thinking Huts. What is the dream and the long-term vision for what you plan to do beyond just the next year or so?
I would really love to replicate it throughout the African continent and also South Asia. We've already been approached by some organizations there, but we just don't have the capacity to scale it within the next few years. But I think it would be amazing to also branch into refugee settlements too. I think that 3D printing can be applied for well beyond just school buildings.
Well, listen, Maggie, we so appreciate you joining us today. It's inspiring to hear what you've been able to do, and we are excited to follow what you will do in the future as well. And we encourage people to head on over and check out your nonprofit organization. Again, it is called Thinking Huts, and thanks so much for joining us on the feed.
Thanks so much for having me, and I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Up next, Amber shares the hottest summer tech, including a camp stove to charge your phone.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Hot stuff.
Welcome back to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. As the weather heats up, many of us are thinking about summer activities for the whole family. And so I have put together a roundup of six of the hottest tech items for the summer. So lots of new stuff that has just become available over the past few days, weeks, and months. And Michael, we're going to start with learning. This is the Nintendo Game Builder Garage. It's a game for the Nintendo Switch system, and it allows you to create your very own video game. So essentially, it's teaching you game design and how to code. You know, it says that it's for people of all ages, and I couldn't agree more. If you think about just watching some of the videos of how this works, and I have the game on our Nintendo Switch, it's really amazing to see how easy it is to learn how to code, and as you know, such an important skill for the future.
It certainly is, and I just love the fact that there's this gamification and the gaming in general. People are like, oh, it's just a computer game. No, there's so much more built in that people don't realize that kids nowadays are actually learning and getting from games, especially this next one. Again, this sounds like a fun activity that the kids could be doing by themselves, you know, during those long summer days, but they're actually learning to put together an entire production.
Yeah. So this is called Lego Video Music Video Maker. And basically what it is an app that works with Lego video. So you get these Lego characters that are kind of like rock stars. There's a bunch of different characters. You build them, and then you can use the app to scan them and you bring them into a music video. So it's augmented reality, something we've talked about a lot, Michael. So basically you can turn any surface in your home into a stage, and these characters come to life and you can create your own music video. So this probably
Amber, all the world is a stage. All the world is a stage, and I want to be a rock star.
Totally. And you know, when you think about games like we just mentioned from Nintendo, when we think about Lego Video Music Video Maker, it really speaks volumes about the next generation. You know, we just talked to Maggie about 3D printing schools in areas where they need them and they can do this affordable. And it kind of makes sense that the next generation is just exposed to so many incredible ways to learn.
Well, you know what? No one's going to get exposed to any kind of learning if they're not connected.
Yeah. So nice segue. So we wanted to talk for a second in terms of hot summer tech. You know, there's a lot of tweens and teens who love gaming, my son included. And this is from TP-Link. And we're going to talk about this a little bit later in the show. So I'll just mention it quickly. It's the GX90 gaming router. So what's super cool about this is that it essentially creates a fast lane for gamers when they're connecting to the internet in their home. And that means that they have super fast response times and it won't be interfering with what mom and dad and everybody else is doing in the home. So it's really about having a pain-free experience in terms of Wi-Fi in the house, knowing that a bunch of people want to be online at the same time.
Well, while you're online, you need to make sure that you're all juiced up. What the devil is Blucer?
You know what? You have to come to my house and you have to check this out because this is so
Remember, I wasn't invited during lockdown because even though I could have been bubbled, that's the story. That's a whole nother debate.
It is. Yeah. But the question now is when are you going to come over and try this? Because so it's the Breville Booster 3X Pro and it's really three products in one. So instead of having a juicer on your counter and a blender on your counter, what you can do is with this one device is that you can actually make your very own juice and then you can blend it as well. So you have a juicer, a blender, and you can bluse. So let me walk you through this. So basically,
I just love the name. Sorry.
Bluser, I know.
Is the best thing. You should buy it just for the fact of the name.
You just need to use it before it totally makes sense because basically imagine peeling a bunch of oranges, dropping them into the bluser, and then it has a spout on it, and then it's going into the blender. So I have fresh squeezed orange juice in like 30 seconds in the blender. Then I want to create a frozen drink in the blender. So I add my frozen items, I put it onto the base, and then I blend it up. So you've made a bluse. So the bluse is the idea of you've made fresh juice and then you've blended it into a bluse. So for hot summer drinks, there's a frozen beverage button as well. So in terms of any daiquiris or fun stuff like that you want to make, it makes it super, super easy. And again, you save counter space because it's an all-in-one.
I love the all-in-one, and I feel like you should all go online and actually tell us what your hashtag, what's your bluser for the summer. The best thing about this blender and juicer is that it actually is an auto-clean feature. That is the music to my ears, and I'm sure many people who just don't want to keep cleaning up different devices and different appliances. So that's great.
Yeah, that I love that as well. So, okay. So next up, if you like to exercise outside in the summer, and for me, it's all about walking my dog all the time or running with my dog. So these are the Huawei FreeBuds 4i. Now, these are earbuds that have active noise cancellation, Michael, and they're just over $100. So let's kind of start there.
That is such a good price because usually wireless headphones can be exceptionally expensive.
Absolutely. You know, any type of earbuds that have that noise activation technology in them or noise cancellation, they can be quite pricey. And so they have a couple of things as well. They have an awareness mode. So let's say that you're running and you're getting to a busy intersection. You've been listening to loud music. You just kind of tap one of the earbuds and then you're able to hear what's around you. They also can basically cancel out some of the wind noise. So if you have to take a call while you're walking or running, then it will reduce the wind noise that's coming in through the earbuds.
So it does let you know if someone's calling you.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So interesting. So does it cancel out specific people when they call? Just curious, asking for a friend.
Michael's upset because I haven't been able to return his call for a while.
Because you're on these amazing devices. These are your new friends. I get
yes,
it.
Yes, cool. It's true. I have a lot of new friends. So super cool. Again, the FreeBuds 4i. And then finally, Michael, I know you're going to love this. It's the BioLite Camp Stove 2 Plus. I first stumbled across this on Instagram. And Jess, one of our team members, and I were just falling in love with it. So basically, it's a compact camp stove that you don't need to use any type of gas or propane. You basically just use twigs or sticks and you put them into the canister, you close it up, and it can basically create heat. So a little fire that you can cook on, but there's
it
a battery.
Just do that. Sorry. Like this is, it says it's so cool. Kettle pot, portable grill, coffee press,
yes,
flex slide, and a stove.
Yes.
That's insane.
Yeah. So it has a little compact battery on the side of it. And so basically as you're creating this clean energy with your twigs and sticks, it can power the battery. And when you power the battery, you can plug in your USB devices. Now don't go crazy. Stick with the smaller ones. So like yeah,
don't suddenly don't like plug in your car.
No, exactly. Your phone or an LED lamp. But you know, it's just super cool for camping. Again, it kind of folds up nice and neatly. And I've always found with camping, you know, it's hard to have a good cooking experience. So I love this idea.
Also
like you
compact
said,
compact and easy, yes, you know, portable and safe. And also, yeah, so I think this is brilliant. But again, it's that multiple uses because you just only have a limited amount of space in your car when you pack everybody up to go camping.
Yeah. And it's a really phenomenal company. You can check them out, called BioLite. They have a bunch of products and it's all focused on the future of clean energy. So I just love this idea again, that you can just take what's around you, like those twigs or sticks, and then you can cook with it and it's not messy.
No one has to go chop down trees or anything.
Right?
And actually that's a game too with the kids, or you can be like, hey, let's go pick up sticks. And then it's actually useful. Okay. So where this is all laid out on your website. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can check out ambermack.com. It's one of the featured stories this week. Summer Tech is the headline. And again, this is all kind of new hot stuff for the summer. I have all of it. So if anyone has any questions, they can let me know.
Now, what was your favorite out of all of them? Was there something you were like, wow, and started to use it more than you thought you would?
Well, to be honest with you, I've been using all of them and just loving all of them. So
I knew you were into, but see, I know that you really rely on a good router, in fairness, because like if that goes down, like I really want to tell people what that, because like honestly, if that goes down, all hell would break loose in your house.
Well,
because your entire life is dependent on being connected.
It's a good point, because I just did a TV interview yesterday and the host was like, well, I know you love routers, so let's talk about the latest.
it's not, people think I'm joking, but it's not. It's not a joke. To get a good router, if you don't have one, you're in serious trouble, especially working from home. All right, check it out, everybody. AmberMac.com, Summer Tech, lots of great picks there. Of course, if you've got an app, a gadget, or any really cool product you think we should check out and let our audience know, tweet us at AmberMac and at MBancroft80. And of course, use the hashtag #TheFeed. Coming up, why you just might want to go to a 5-star space camp.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. In the spotlight.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Now, we've talked a lot about the future of space travel on the show. So what about actually preparing for space and how everyday people will make the transition to this form of transportation? Astronaut training, if you think about it, is extremely intense. So what will it look like for private citizens? Orbit is offering up space camps and training programs to prepare travelers. And its co-founder, Jason Andrews, is joining us now. Jason, this is quite an interesting enterprise. Let's start with the beginning. How did you guys form this and come about? What is the foundation, the principle behind this?
Yeah, so I've been a passionate person focused on commercial human space flight for 20 years. I'm a serial space entrepreneur, started multiple companies. My co-founder, Nicholas Gohm, is also a tech entrepreneur and has a biological space company. And we felt that the time was right. This next decade, the decade in the 2020s, is really about commercial human space flight. And while people have been focused on building the vehicles that will take you to space, no one has been focused on training the next generation of commercial astronauts, people who are going to go there for either pleasure or go there for profession. Historically, governments have trained astronauts. They don't train private citizens. And we saw a need to prepare people mentally, physically, and spiritually for their off-world experience.
I love that you're thinking about this, because you're exactly right. We hear about all of these high profile tech entrepreneurs who are getting ready to go to space, but I've never really thought, are they physically fit enough to do just that? So I love the idea that we're thinking about the training process. So talk to us a little bit about what it will take to go to space. And also, can you put going to space into context? Because I realize there are different levels of going to space in terms of whether you're going as a passenger, in terms of just travel, or maybe you're planning to be an astronaut in the future. There are probably two levels of training, I'm guessing.
No, you're absolutely right, Amber. It's like you don't just get off the couch and strap into a rocket and go. everyone is physically capable of going to space, but it is a bit of an adventure sport. You know, you just don't get off the couch and climb Mount Everest. You got to work up to it. So going to space, there's a couple elements. First of all, you have to get off the planet, which means going through a rocket launch, which is a high G experience, anywhere from 3 Gs to 5 Gs. Because what goes up must also come down. And you tend to see the higher G's on reentry than ascent. And then you go through a phase of weightlessness, which, again, everyone is capable of experiencing, but it's kind of like that moment you go over the top of a roller coaster. You know, there's the butterflies in your stomach, and you just get the natural reactions for everyone to start flapping their wings, because They want to, you know, grab onto something or control themselves. And the reality is that you're in weightlessness. There's nothing there. So we, you know, you talked about the multiple levels. In this decade, people will be able to do a suborbital space flight that is measured in minutes. You will get in and see the Earth as, you know, the pale blue dot that we talk about and you see in pictures. And then beyond that, you go off and can live and work in space for days to weeks to months or longer. And so what we've done is taken, you know, there's been 60 years of commercial human spaceflight. We've taken what has been perfected by NASA and others and distilled that down into a short course, you know, that is available for individuals and professionals. And that's what Orbeet does. You know, we're an astronaut training and a space experience company. We're there to train people, but also let for those people who maybe can't afford the, going to a full ticket to go to space, the ability to come and experience what it's like to train as an astronaut so that you can at some point try before you buy and think about what you want to do long term. But for those who can't afford a ticket, the opportunity to really prepare to enjoy your journey. So we will go through high G training. We will go through zero G training. We will focus on mental preparation for what happens when you get into those uncomfortable situations, what it's like to live and work in space if you focus on doing our orbital program. So it builds up to a suborbital training program, which is 3 to 4 days, followed by an orbital training program, which is 4 to 5 weeks. And then for people that want to live and work in space, we have specialized programs that are a little bit longer.
I'm glad you brought up the mental training, because I think this is actually really important, especially coming out of the global pandemic, because in fairness, a lot of people did not go cope well at all. And they have, you know, they're on the planet and they're able to go outside and those things, you know, everyone was in an uproar about getting 45 minutes a day. How important is mental training? Because my understanding of any astronaut I've ever interviewed ever in my career so far, you know, it's a very disciplined, focused on teamwork and trust, and it's a very controlled environment. And, you know, when we're going into space and we're asking everyday citizens, you're suddenly going to be in a closed, confined environment for long periods of time, not being able to shower the same way and wear different clothes and eat different things. Like, how do you go about training that mental side of the journey?
No, that's a great question. So like any training, it's about a little bit of repetition. It's a little bit about preparation. So it's educating people on here's what you're going to experience. Here is some techniques for coping with some uncomfortable situations. And then you actually go through an actual physical exercise to get ready for it. Just like, I mean, I've done high G training and I'm a bit of a venture junkie and I was shocked by, whoa, you know, when is this going to end? So you just need to go do it a couple times so that you are familiar with the experience. It's like the first time you go scuba diving or maybe, you know, fly an airplane. There's panic, but once you, the whole point is repeat it so that you get used to it. The other part of what we're doing on the mental preparation is also what we like to say is spiritual preparation. If you talk to, as you've probably interviewed many astronauts, they talk about the overview effect, the fact that once you finally get into space and you see a planet versus a flat surface, you feel very small in the presence of the cosmos. You know, we want to, part of what we're trying to do is prepare people for the fact that, you know, they may have a spiritual experience too, and it's hard to share these really unique experiences with your friends and loved ones when you come back and they haven't experienced it. So it's also, you know, building, for lack of a better word, a club of like-minded individuals who've gone through that experience so that you have people you can talk to about it after you come back. So we're really see ourselves almost as guides, or a guiding service to walk people through this journey. Because ultimately, we want them to have a good time. You know, you may spend $500,000 to go on a suborbital flight. The last thing you want to do is be terrified during launch, so you're not enjoying it. And you get to the top of the parabola, you unbuckle, and you don't know how to get back into your seat. You feel nauseated. You vomit on the person next to you. Heaven forbid, you can't get back into your seat before you hit the atmosphere again. You injure yourself. I mean, that's a bad day for the industry, and we want to make sure that doesn't happen. So that's, when we talk about mental, physical, and spiritual preparation, that's what we're talking about.
One last question for you, because if we think about going to space, whether it is the people designing the rockets or the people who are training to go to space, it's in a very elite group of people. How can we possibly expose other people to what it takes to go to space who maybe don't have the funds to participate right away in one of these space camps? What is your opinion on that, to just have more equity in terms of exposure to what space could be like?
Well, that's one of our prime missions. We believe the same thing. I mean, space travel in the 2020s is going to unfortunately be for those with high net worths, because we're just not there yet. But the price will come down very soon. And you can look at commercial air travel in the 1920s and the 1930s, and a century later, it's a very there's a lot of analogies. But what we're doing at Orbi is not only having our astronaut training programs to prepare these people, but our programs, you know, cost tens of thousands of dollars versus hundreds of thousands of dollars for tickets suborbital flight, or millions of dollars for an orbital flight. So it's available to a lot of people who can't afford to go to space, and we want to be there to educate people and allow them to experience space. That's why we say we're an astronaut training and space experience company, and building an astronaut training and space experience facility, so that everyday people can come and see what it's like to train as an astronaut and feel like they are going to space in their own way.
Well, listen, we encourage people to check you out online. Again, it's called Orbeet. And we so appreciate you taking time and joining us on the feed.
Thank you both for the opportunity.
Up next, how tuk-tuks and rickshaws are making their way to digital maps.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Techstar.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. In emerging markets, up to 80% of the population may have to rely on informally run public transport to get around. Where Is My Transport compiles information on the routes of minibus taxis, tuk-tuks, or rickshaws that dart through mega cities that aren't often shown on any formal maps. To talk to us more about how this works is Devin DeVries, who is CEO of Where Is My Transport. Thanks for being here, Devin.
Great to be here, Amber. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this. You're exactly right. Informally run public transport does not show up on many maps. So how do you change that?
So the work that we're doing relies on the fact that we build localized teams within these markets, or these cities in emerging markets, and utilizing those teams on the ground of individuals who are typically regular public transport users, we actually set out to map all of the forms of transportation. And that is inclusive, actually, the formal transits, so the bus, the trains, the overground, underground, but also these informally run transit systems, which are essentially independently owned and operated vehicles that are serving the public, so operating like public transport, but absent any kind of a city subsidy, as formal transport typically does. And so, yeah, we empower the individuals in these markets with tools to map out those transit systems. We then process all of that data, clean it, validate it, and then output it in a format that is useful for other mapping and technology companies to utilize on their maps, so that much like they provide data on a London or a New York or San Francisco, similarly, they can now start to provide information that actually extends to all modes of transportation and public transportation specifically within these emerging markets as well.
How difficult is it to actually map these routes? Because obviously, I assume that's kind of one of the reasons, because of the difficulty, is why it hasn't been done, I guess, from the larger companies that we see. I mean, obviously, a lot of people are familiar with seeing Google cars driving around some places when they've got the cameras on top and they're taking their mapping. So how difficult is it to do these routes that are often overlooked? Or is it just simply because it's in certain markets where people don't care as much? I know that's horrible to say, but it is something to think about.
Well, as you can imagine, technology and technology services have thrived first and foremost in our first billion user markets, our developed markets. However, now that a lot of these products and technologies are looking for growth opportunity, those growth opportunities principally exist within these next billion user markets, or these majority world cities, as we like to call them at Where Is My Transport. And so, when you look at the way that these large companies might solve the challenge of putting transit data on the map in a developed market, they're able to obtain all this data from the central government, the transportation authority. However, within these emerging markets, the challenge that you have is one of fragmentation. So you've got tens of thousands of independent operators who, while they work in unison to some degree, there is no unifying, authority that is centralizing and managing all of that information. So that's really been the gap that we've had to step into in order to solve. I would say the challenge is actually largely one of fragmentation and one of people not realizing that this is something that is solvable. And, you know, some of the approaches that have been used before, people have attempted to use machine learning on telemetry data and using satellite imagery. But the reality is, unlike mapping out pathways the way we can do for private transport, public transit is actually about the services that are being provisioned. And so you're not able to simply gather large amounts of data from satellites and telemetry, crunch that in order to retroactively produce complete transit data. But rather, you have to take a much more bottom-up approach of actually mapping out each of these transportation routes, the stops, understanding the fares, the timetables, the frequencies across that city, and then also set up a process by which you can constantly evaluate, update, and improve the quality of the data set that you're providing for that market. So I don't think it's as simple as saying it's just because it's difficult or it's because there's less attractive from a financial standpoint. Rather, it's a whole range of factors that sort of come together to allow the sector to fly largely under the radar from our technology and service standpoint, but now is very much surfacing it to the top of the stack for a lot of these companies.
Can you talk a little bit about the role that some of the big tech players can play as you partner with them, knowing that, of course, when we talk about maps, we're thinking of Apple and Google, who really dominate this space?
Yeah, so I mean, the ability to work with these companies to license the data to them is very helpful in allowing that this information starts to actually have an impact on people's lives. It also starts to breathe financial life into the ecosystem of maintaining and managing these data sets in these markets. Because at the end of the day, a lot of these companies have traditionally relied on data being available from the public sector. And so that public sector data that would be freely available would enable them to operate in those markets. But the absence of that has required private sector companies like ourselves to step into that space to actually solve for it. So it's actually a symbiotic relationship in getting to work with these companies to ensure that the data that we are collecting on these transit systems actually has a direct impact on people's lives and their ability to move throughout the cities. To your question on sort of how those companies can help further, I mean, we all know that there is an enormous amount of data that's also held within these large tech companies. And so being able to take that data, blend it with these public transport data sets in order to start to infer better real-time information is definitely one of the areas which we're really excited about, where you start to see sort of a 1+1=3 scenario when you bring the power of a big tech data company's data together with a private sector company.
Well, listen, we so appreciate you taking the time to join us again. The company is called Where Is My Transport? Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Coming up next, we debate whether we'll ever, ever, ever see a flying car driving highs.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Socially Speaking.
It's time now for Socially Speaking, but just a quick reminder that this episode of The Feed is powered by TP-Link. TP-Link routers and technology can remove wireless pain points in your home so you have better performance for working, streaming, and gaming. We talked a little bit about gaming earlier on in the show, and the TP-Link Archer GX90 AX6600 gaming router will give gamers in your house greater capacity and low latency. Plus, it's equipped with Wi-Fi 6 so they can game in the fast lane without disrupting other online activities. latencies. For gamers, this means no more lagging in the middle of a crucial shot, so their network speeds are as fast as their reaction needs. The TP-Link Archer GX90 is easy to set up with the Tether app, and you can get more information at TP-Link Online. Okay, for this week's Socially Speaking segment, we are going to speak about flying cars. And I thought this was an interesting article in the New York Times. And the headline is, "What is a flying car?" And it says, "Inside Silicon Valley's 10-year quest to make soaring above a crowded city street as easy as calling an Uber." We have been talking about flying cars, guys, for many, many years. I guess the question is, Michael, I'll start with you. How do they differentiate from helicopters and planes? Except, of course, they have more functionality because they could presumably fly and then drive as well.
Yeah. And so I think that's an interesting point. So both you and I have interviewed many, many founders of companies all over the world that are working and developing vehicles in the flying car space. And it's a good point. There's a difference between flying cars, flying taxis, how you differentiate. So most recently, there was a company that I interviewed that can take off and land directly without having to use a runway. So they would lift up just like a helicopter, but when they land, they can then be a car and kind of drive off. So you've got that vertical direct takeoff, and it is an individual that driving the car, or I guess then turns into a drone or a plane. I don't know what they're going to end up calling it, because obviously a car drives on a road. That's what we think about. And obviously a plane flies in the air. But I don't think that we're going to see this anytime soon in any real mass way or adoption, just because, again, infrastructure, regulation, all the same things that we talk about when it comes to drones everywhere and autonomous vehicles. It sounds great, but I mean, you know, we live in Toronto. They've got a freeway that's dilapidated and falling down. So we're thinking about infrastructure for flying cars zipping around and adding to another layer of highways in the sky. And we can't even take care of our own infrastructure. That's what we're trying to deal with today. So I don't know. It's very difficult to comprehend and understand that we're going to get there anytime soon. And also just think about your neighbor being able to drive out of their driveway and then suddenly take off in the air. Just think about that. Think about your neighbors, people. Think if that's what you want happening.
Yeah. And Aaron, just a quick question to you, because we talk so much about emerging technology on this show, but I think when you actually put things into practice within an urban area like Toronto, you start to realize that there's a lot of things we just can't seem to accomplish.
Yeah, Michael just said, imagine your neighbor driving out of their driveway. I don't even have a driveway in my part of downtown Toronto. We have back alley parking. I mean, it's kind of a conundrum that you talk about infrastructure and density and urban freeways falling down, which are all true. But an area where this could work, I think, is some of the most densely populated areas, like in parts of Brazil and Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. Helicopters are used very frequently as forms of for commuters of various stripes. So I feel like maybe density is the key, but you're right. It's kind of a double-edged sword of do you use helicopter infrastructure? How soon? You're right. There's so many things in the way of infrastructure, regulation, classification, licensing, implementation of what constitutes a pilot's license for this versus a pilot's license versus a driver's license. In places like dense places like Hong Kong, Sao Paulo, maybe we'll see them there before we see them in Toronto or New York or even Los Angeles.
But Aaron makes a good point, Amber, because again, just think of it from, okay, so if I'm going to take off at the moment, if I'm in a light aircraft, even if I'm just a pilot doing this for a hobby, I still have to map out my flight path. I have to put it in with the tower. I have to, everywhere I am in the, you know, towers, control towers are tracking me. So how does that work with thousands of people now taking to the skies on a lower scale and lower to the ground from So I don't think it's, people have really thought about it. And then we have traffic systems and cameras and all of this stuff on the ground. You're going to have to replicate that, you know, higher up, whether it, you know, above building. It doesn't make any sense. And it's great to look to the future. But I mean, realistically, I mean, it goes to your, you've said this point many times when we talk about going to space, it's like, well, shouldn't we kind of fix what's happening on Earth first? So yes. It's like, before we go to the skies, maybe we fix what's happening on the ground first.
Yeah. And honestly, I am so completely jaded about the possibilities of future technology in a time where over the past few months, even booking a vaccine requires 25 hours a week online and usually leads to no luck whatsoever. So I am
and that's basic healthcare, right? Would you classify that as basic healthcare, I guess? I don't know.
Yeah, I would. And you see how even for a city and a province and a country to all work together to enable a system where people are able to get easy access, how we've sort of failed from a booking perspective in terms of making it accessible for all. And so then all this other stuff, I find I'm sometimes less hopeful about it. Let us know what you think.
And yet you can book an Uber and get stuff delivered to your house easily. Just saying.
I'm probably going to have a car flying before I get dosed too. All right. That's it for the show. Thank you so much for being with us. Remember, you can tweet us at Amber Mac and at MBancroft80. And please use the hashtag The Feed.
This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B on SiriusXM Canada Talks, Channel 167.